All right, so I'd like to introduce Marcus Kummer, who is the VP of Public Policy at the Internet Society. He recently joined the Internet Society in February and advances key policy positions on issues including privacy, cybersecurity, and network neutrality. And previously, he was the executive coordinator of the Secretariat supporting the UN's Internet Governance Forum and has extensive experience with Internet policy at the global, regional, and national levels.
Thank you for the introduction. Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to chair this panel of distinguished experts. The title is rather long and complex: New Privacy Models in an Age of Mobility, Social Networking, and Cloud Computing. How can we encourage a new technology approach that balances online privacy, security, and reliability while also fostering innovation? Is this possible? And there are more questions following that, so I will not go into that. Luckily, I have experts who will be able to explain what it means. Let me just say a few random thoughts when introducing this discussion. First of all, what is privacy? And I would like to remind the audience that we don't have a universally agreed definition on privacy. There are big cultural, social, and I think also generational differences in regarding privacy. I come from Europe, where on the whole the view is held that European standards on privacy are much higher than American standards, so I'd be interested hearing from the panelists how they see the situation. Nevertheless, I mean, the right to privacy is recognized. There is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which means all the nations of the earth, all members of the United Nations, have subscribed to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and Article 12 specifically recognizes a right to privacy there. No one shall be subject to arbitrary interference with his privacy, the article begins. However, we heard this afternoon, I think Vint Cerf who said it, or was it this morning, privacy is a hard act to come by nowadays. And Mark Zuckerberg, as I think, said early this year, and was it, the privacy is dead, get over it. So there are definitely conflicting views and there are tension in this field. But without further ado, I would like to introduce our panelists. To my right is the Internet Society's Lucy Lynch, Director of Trust and Identity Initiatives. She is our foremost expert on these issues. And on my left, we have Rebecca Wright, Professor for the Department of Computer Science at Rutgers University. And then I go to her left, Jonathan Cannon, Director of Information Security Policy and Strategy at UPS Information Services. And to his left, Stephen Hughes, Chief Information Security Officer of the Citibank of North America. And to the right of Lucy, we have Leonard L. Gordon, the director of the Northeast Regional Office of the Federal Trade Commission. We thought of starting maybe with a more theoretical approach, first by Lucy and then by Rebecca, and then go on to the regulatory framework. And at the end, we hear from the practitioners where they see the challenges and where they would like the privacy discussion to head for. Please, Lucy.
So I'll be brief. As Marcus says, my remit at the Internet Society is our trust and identity initiatives, and that's really technically implemented trust at the network layer and above, but identity in its broadest context, meaning socially managed, user-managed identity, and in particular online. Privacy has been a driving issue for us this last year, as it has been for many people. And I was glad to hear somebody use the phrase wicked problem this morning, because privacy really is a wicked problem in the classic sense of the 9 or 10 elements of a wicked problem. And Marcus has mentioned that there is no standing definition of privacy, but we've been using a sort of shorthand definition of online privacy that's derived from the OECD privacy guidelines that were recently revised. The definition that we're using for online privacy is sharing data in an explicit context with an expectation of scope. Now, that seems very, very brief, but it's really about a transaction of data, not a one-way flow. It's about an expectation, about a specific context, so it's about sharing that data with some parameters around it and for a specific use, and it's about expectations for use. So that's where you get into things like consent, agreement, revocation. There are a lot of complex issues related to privacy that you can pack into that little tiny short definition. As Marcus mentioned, I think privacy lives in a Venn with security and with reliability. If you think about the network and the way the network works, reachability is dependent on identifiers. Vint did a great job of distinguishing between what identifiers and identities are. But identifiers are really important in the current context of privacy because data correlation is possible in part because people surrender both identifiers and personally identifying information when they're online. All of those problems get wrapped up in what I think of as the convenience problem, which is ease of use. Most of you know that users will surrender quite a bit for convenience. How many of you are iTunes users? How many of you read all 41 pages of the recent click-through license? How many of you just clicked through? So, issues that I think are important, as I said, data correlation because it brings identity and identifiers together. Data protection, which I think would classically be thought of as a security issue, but if I'm interested in my privacy and my data rests somewhere else, I'm highly interested in the security of the facility where it rests. Transparency of terms, this is your iTunes click-through issue. Consent, agreement, and what you agree to online, there can be tacit agreement. You use a service and you buy a lot of other things that come with the free. There can be active agreement where terms are explicit and you accept terms. And then there's a growing movement around negotiated agreement, things like Project VRM, where people actually can say, I will offer these attributes or these pieces of my data in exchange for these escalated services. I think it's important to remember in the context of the conversation that we were having earlier today that privacy is not the same as secrecy or anonymity or pseudonymity. Those things can be tools of privacy, but privacy may also require a high degree of proof if you want to have a private transaction with your doctor with assurance on both ends that you're the patient and he's the doctor and the data is secure. I think wrapping all of those items into one package and making it understandable to the end user results in the wicked problem we call privacy.
Thank you for that. And over straight to you, Rebecca.
Okay. And I have some slides which maybe are up there, maybe not. Okay, so I'm actually going to agree with and repeat some of the things that Lucy said, maybe from a slightly different perspective. Absolutely, I think one of the things that makes privacy such a hard problem is that we don't even know what we mean. We all mean different things. Each one of us doesn't even know what we mean. It means different things depending on the culture, depending on the context, and it's much easier for people to see that their privacy has been violated in some way to tell you in advance what would make them feel that that would be the case. But at its heart, it's really around appropriate uses of data. But then there are questions of what is appropriate, who gets to decide what's appropriate, and when different stakeholders in some information disagree, which one of them gets to be the one that decides. I just want to highlight, and I could have given a whole, you know, one-hour talk on this or more, that simple approaches to anonymization, the idea that you can take some data and strip out the parts about people, really don't work, and they particularly don't work in today's world where many different data sources can be brought together and correlated to each other, and you can sort of use the clues and what you do know to find out who someone is, and then once you have that, you can use that to learn all kinds of other interesting things about them. So it's tempting to just say, you know, just strip off a few fields, identifiers, obvious identifiers, but that, unfortunately, is not going to lead to a good match between the statement of providing some privacy and the actual expectations that the users have, and not getting that feeling that you've violated it. But nonetheless, there are some good definitions for specific notions of privacy, and I'm just going to highlight a couple of them that come sort of from my world as a computer science researcher that works on fairly mathematical aspects of computer science. And so when systems and people meet, mathematical definitions are not always straightforward. I can define something mathematical, but if it doesn't capture, again, that sort of feeling of what people mean when they say they care about privacy, then it's not a useful definition. But if you can find a definition that does have a good match to some of what people mean when they talk about privacy, then it can be useful for capturing those particular aspects and using that to drive solutions. Because the nice thing about a mathematical definition is you can sort of hope, at least, to, if you're clever enough in how you design your system and analyze your system, you can hope to say it really is met or it really is not met. And know whether you've done that or not. So one approach that I find very interesting, it uses cryptographic methods to hide information while allowing certain computations to happen, is when you're dealing with data analysis, the usual paradigm is to bring multiple data sources together, take them all into one place, combine that data, do your analysis, and then you have your results, which is whatever kind of knowledge you were seeking. Instead, if you can use something called secure multi-party computation, and I'm not going to give you the scientific references, but these terms are enough that you should be able to find quite a rich body of literature on the web. Secure multi-party computation replaces this need to bring that data together with a secure distributed protocol, something that uses encryption but in a more sophisticated way than just I send, you decrypt, but lets me send you some data that you can not decrypt, but you can manipulate in a certain way to combine your data, and then we can still produce the same results that we want. So this is not a panacea that's going to solve all privacy concerns, but it's very useful if the concern at hand is about that step of combining data in a centralized location. This lets you get the effects of that without actually combining them. Another approach of differential privacy is a more recent approach that's been put forth in the last maybe 5 to 10 years. And intuitively, it's a very, very mathematical definition and flavor, and it provides a guarantee that says that when someone interacts with a database, they're going to get essentially the same results whether that database contains one particular person or does not. And essentially what this is saying then is that one individual, and this is something that should apply to every individual, has a good sense of privacy because their data is not giving a significant contribution to the output. So so this is one that, again, is not useful everywhere, but it's very useful in cases where the claim that someone's making about privacy is that it's not highly dependent on an individual. So people often say, I'm only reporting aggregate results, and so you don't have to worry about privacy. And it turns out, again, because of that data correlation, that that's not actually, strictly speaking, true. It may be a higher bar, but someone can potentially disaggregate by using what they do know and combining different data sources. Here, you get a very strong protection for that one individual, and if the kinds of results that you want to produce are ones that really don't depend on single individuals, like truly aggregate results or synthetic data, there's a body of results here that can give you good methodology for providing that. And then turning a little bit to a different direction, one of the things that I and others have been looking at more recently is the extent to which accountability can be used to enhance or replace some of the needs for certain kinds of mechanisms, and particularly around privacy. So we hear a lot about accountability and the need for systems that provide accountability, and we hear it a lot in the real world, sort of human contexts that are going to provide accountability around how people use a system. But you can also look at trying to build that in some way inherently. And here also, exact definitions are a little bit elusive, but the basic idea is that you want to ensure that when people don't follow the rules, they suffer some kind of consequences. And ideally, the fact that these consequences are there will act as a deterrent, but if not, they'll actually be there as well to happen. And what I want to point out is this does not inherently require or disrequire the idea of identification and tracking at all times. In particular, I think it's most interesting when it does not require but that you can still hope to build systems that provide some kind of accountability in that when someone does violate the norms or the rules as stated, there's some mechanism for holding them accountable. And I just think this may be a useful shift, a paradigm shift from privacy approaches based solely on prevention, because prevention is so difficult, especially when there is potentially some ambiguity around what the expectations and the context are. So that's sort of a bit of optimism, but pessimistically, why are these not deployed? There's a number of real and or perceived barriers that currently prevent these from being widespread in their use. They can be too complicated and difficult to use, and that can be both from the perspective of the people, the technology developers. It can be from the perspective of the technology maintainers and managers, and it can be from the perspective of the end users. So all of those need to be addressed and worked with. There's concerns of efficiency, especially around some of the secure multi-party computation where you're adding sophisticated encryption on top of things. Readiness for deployment, certainly an issue on all of these. More research, but especially sort of that transition from research to development is needed to get them deployed. And fundamentally, one of the underlying issues is potentially a misalignment of incentives. The people who care about the privacy in a given setting are not necessarily the same people who are making the decisions. And so certainly policies can and laws can bring those incentives together, but that's not always the case. So back to optimism, though, for moving towards the future. So I think there's no single best balance between privacy, security, reliability, and usability that applies both to the internet infrastructure and internet applications. I think the idea that there can be balance is in some ways a fiction. I think it changes contextually over time in different contexts. But I think thinking about both and trying to achieve both or all of these goals is certainly important. There was a question in the charge of our panel about innovation that implied that innovation might be hampered by privacy, and I just want to say that I don't think they should be viewed that way. I think privacy and security should be seen, rather than limiting innovation, as requiring more innovation. I think we should see this as a call to provide better and more innovative solutions. It's a little bit harder maybe in the infrastructure, but certainly among internet applications, you can use privacy or security as a differentiator. So, you know, there's room out there in the marketplace for different kinds of solutions that provide different properties to different communities that wish to use them. Thinking about users and uses and usability is crucial. There are users, not just the end users, but those who have to manage the technology. That certainly matters. And finally, I think critically, technology, policy, and education need to work together. Just moving one front forward alone is not going to make a difference.
Thank you for that. I would also like to throw in the word balance makes me somewhat a little bit nervous, because it implies a zero-sum game, and whereas all these elements should be mutually reinforcing in an ideal world. But let's turn now to Leonard. It says in your bio that you supervise the investigation and litigation of both consumer protection and antitrust matters. So you have a lot to tell us, I suppose. Please.
Sure. First, thank you for inviting me here today. This is really an interesting and exciting event. I also have to disclaim that which I'll say today represent my views and not necessarily those of the Commission or its commissioners, especially if we get into some interesting Q&A later on. Listening to the discussion about privacy, I was struck by a comment that Justice Potter Stewart made some time ago trying to define what obscenity was, and ultimately he sort of threw up his hands in his opinion and said, well, you know it when you see it. And that's sort of what the discussion is like with privacy. It's very, very difficult to reach a societal consensus, and that makes what we do in law enforcement challenging. I'll touch briefly upon some of the law enforcement efforts that the Federal Trade Commission has undertaken recently, and then also talk a little bit about the privacy report that the agency issued at the end of last year. Some quick numbers. The agency's brought 35 data security cases, 64 do not call cases, 83 Fair Credit Reporting Act cases, 96 canned spam cases, 15 spyware cases, and 15 Children Online Privacy Protection Act cases. So we've been active there, but there's a lot more to do. A couple of interesting cases recently was one against Twitter, and this has nothing to do with Anthony Weiner, though you will see some similarities there as I go into this. Twitter had a function that said it would let its users protect their tweets, protect my tweets, and they would be privately disseminated. Twitter promised that it was using administrative, physical, and electronic measures to protect these private tweets. We allege that hackers were able to get in there by guessing very weak, easy-to-use passwords, and that tweets that people thought were private became public. Now, there's a little bit of symmetry there with Congressman Weiner, but I'll stop my comments there. So we got them under consent decree to make sure that when, and this is typical of the kind of action we take. When companies promise consumers something about privacy, they fail to abide by that promise, we find that's a deceptive practice, and we try and remedy that. We recently entered a consent decree with a company called Echometrics, which sold Sentry. Sentry looked like a great product. It allowed parents to monitor their children's online activity. It could block and filter websites, record IM conversations, all kinds of wonderful things. You know, I have two 11-year-olds and a 6-year-old. This is the kind of thing I would be interested in, perhaps. Echometrics, however, did not disclose to parents that this information that they would be gathering through this filtering mechanism, they were then going to sell to third-party marketers. We thought that was wrong, and the laughter that I hear throughout the room, I seem to think that you agree. Chitika, not the banana people, but close. They were an online advertising agency, and they sought to differentiate themselves by promising consumers that they could opt out of being tracked on the Internet. We thought that was great. And if you followed their software, it might work, but it only worked for 10 days, and they didn't tell people that. So that, again, we found that to be a deceptive practice. Google Buzz, when Google launched Buzz, gave Gmail users two options. Sweet, check out Buzz, or nah, I just want to go to my inbox. We allege that Google failed to disclose that clicking on Sweet meant all the information was going to get sucked out of their email. They didn't really, we thought, adequately disclose that. We also thought that they didn't adequately disclose that even if you clicked nah, certain information from your Gmail account might be accessed by Google and used to populate Buzz. Interesting, there we also had some issues with their promises to that they were treating information in accord with the Safe Harbor Privacy Framework from Europe, and found that that was not so. The consent decree there requires them not to gather information for one purpose and then use it for another. That's consistent with how the agencies looked at privacy in the past, but when a company like Google that's constantly evolving, that will be an interesting order provision for them to keep. They also have to submit to some monitoring and revamp their privacy program in a fairly significant way. All right, let me now segue to the privacy report. And to get to the privacy report, I have to explain a little bit about how we got there. The Commission, in thinking about privacy, historically has used two frameworks. One, notice and choice. That is, the consumer should be notified of the kind of information about them that is being collected and have some choice. But as Lucy mentioned, that framework is illusory at best. Apple's user license was, 60 pages? No one reads them. No one can understand them. They resemble mortgage closing documents. No one reads their mortgage closing documents. And we've seen where that ended us up in the financial crisis. Similarly, though, people do not read these. They don't understand it. Consumers are not exercising meaningful choice. And consumers don't understand the kinds of data that is being collected about them. And if, notice and choice is the framework that we're applying, where consumers really don't have notice and really don't have choice, that's not a very good framework. And I think if you were to look at the cases that the Commission's brought, the one that sort of was the tipping point was the case that we brought against Sears. Sears rolled out a program called My Sears Experience or something like that. They paid consumers $10 to enroll in this program. What the program essentially was, however, wasn't something just to enhance their shopping experience online at Sears. It was spyware. It recorded almost everything that a consumer did on their computer. It could access prescription information, banking information, you name it, if it's on the computer, this software could access it. Sears had no idea what it was going to do with half of this data or most of this data, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. Now, if you read the license agreement in the fifth or sixth page, in the 70th or so paragraph or subparagraph, if you read it very, very carefully and really parsed the words, you would understand that that's what you were agreeing to for your $10. But we felt that that was not the way a typical consumer was going to react to this offer for $10 while they're, looking for hardware on the Sears website, and this offer was presented to them. There was never any allegation by us that the information was misused. Frankly, we got to this fairly early. But I think there's, you know, a real tipping point. It was disclosed. There was no consumer harm, but we felt that this was the wrong thing to do. The other framework that the commission has used over time is harm. And there, typically, the harm has been financial. Credit cards have been compromised from a retailer or a financial institution, and there's a real risk that consumers are going to be out money or going to be out inconvenience from trying to deal with the consequences of identity theft. The notion, though, is that too narrow a definition of harm? Is there some kind of dignity interest or ick factor, if you will, from having some of your online behavior tracked and aggregated without really understanding that that's happening? So that was one of the motivating concerns for the privacy report. So the privacy report grew out of a series of public roundtables and forums. We issued the report in December. We asked for comments. We got 450 or so. The agency is trying to work its way through those and figure out how the recommendations in the report should be altered. The report has three main components. The first is privacy by design. Businesses need to incorporate privacy into their business processes. It's a flexible standard, depending on the kinds of data that you collect, the kinds of information that you have about consumers, but it needs to be part of your business process. It can't just be an afterthought. It's got to be engineered from the beginning. Companies need to think about the kinds of data they collect and how they maintain it. You know, the ease of electronic storage is wonderful because it's much easier to just hold on to stuff than to get rid of it because storage becomes cheaper and cheaper. The problem is companies hold on to more and more data. Frequently, they don't really have business uses for it anymore, but it's just sitting there, and some ingenious hacker is going to figure out a way to get to it. Second part of the privacy report, simpler, more meaningful consumer choice about their data, whether it's collected and what uses are made of it. That's where the do not track proposal comes in. And third, greater transparency. Consumers should have a better sense of what data is collected about them. And here, I think this has been a theme throughout, there needs to be better education. Consumers need to understand better that part of the bargain for a lot of the free content on the internet is that they give up certain information about themselves. And so they can decide whether they want that or whether they don't. But there needs to be much more education about that. And with that, I'll sort of stop for now.
Thank you very much. Can we turn now to the very left, to Stephen, and to tell us from your banking experience.
Thank you. Being with a financial institution and one of the largest in the world, I think for us there's really two threads, quite a bit of which has been touched on here. One is the area of privacy rights. Because we're global, we have to worry about over 100 countries. And it's challenging enough in the U.S. there's this constant escalation of, I think it's not the concept of privacy, but the definition and what constitutes a piece of data that is or is not private. And a good example is people in the U.S. are very casual about sharing their email addresses, but in some European jurisdictions, you can't capture that in your system because it's considered a violation of privacy. Some countries, you can't capture IP addresses, things like that. We struggle with that partly because of so much of it is interpretive. Along with that is the fact that our customers more and more are moving to the online space. And the convenience problem comes up, right? You want to keep there on the, besides the fiduciary responsibility, we're very focused on our reputation, and absolutely key to that is our customer trust. So we don't want customers to think we're not doing everything we can to keep them safe. And then you have people who don't like the other measures that we put in place. A good example is if you typically log on from your home or your office and then you happen to be on vacation in Mexico and we present some additional challenge questions, people don't like it. Related to that, frankly, is also the whole issue of what makes up your identity and how you protect that from the people who are trying to get your money. You know, we are, because of our size and our visibility, we're constantly under attack. Consistently, Citibank Online or Egg.com are right up there at the top sites being attacked by the fraudsters. And we do a lot of things in the background to try and address the fact that even things that people think are private are not necessarily. We just had a case a few months ago where we found that some fraudsters set themselves up as a collection agency so they could pull credit reports, because if they've got your credit report, they don't, you know, they've got your mother's maiden name and all that sort of thing. So we do other things that are really about anomalous behavior. But then that comes right up against the do not track type of legislation, because you're trying to build something, some data that tells you whether this is unusual behavior. For example, if I always go to the ATM in my neighborhood or certain places when I travel, and then one time they see me taking out $1,000 in a city I've never been to at 3 a.m., that's something that I want the system to alert people to. But again, this comes up against the growing trend on the regulatory side to protect people's privacy. And it's definitely, we're going in two different directions. Another quote from Mark Zuckerberg that I thought was somewhat amusing was, he said, "The default now is sharing." I certainly don't think that's universal, and certainly not about your financial transactions. And not just banking, right? E-commerce. You know, I think that there's a growing, Citi is in partnership on the idea of the wallet on your phone. It's a great idea. People love it. But I don't think anyone wants that information shared. I think that ultimately what would make this all much easier for us is if your identity didn't have anything to do with your personally identifiable information. If we had some sort of secure portable identity, I leave that to the technical geniuses to come up with it, because we certainly don't have it now. But the idea that I have to worry about who knows my social and who knows my mother's maiden name, this is pretty primitive stuff when you really think about it, and it is not difficult for someone who's dedicated to get. You know, if you have enough in your account to make you a good target, and believe me, they know who has large balances. They can tell through other factors, as Rebecca was saying. There's a lot, the fraudsters are doing a lot of data aggregation now. So they'll get a little bit from here, a little bit from there, and they build up a profile, and that makes them want to try and attempt to take over your account, if you're a high net worth individual in particular. And they, as I said with the example with the collection agency, they can get enough information to spoof your identity. Just read an interesting article about in Russia at the ATM now, one of the banks is installing software that have a voice print, but not only does it recognize your voice, but it can tell if you're lying. So this is, I don't think we could get away with that in this country. You know, there's a lot of these innovative ideas, ultimately we're going to need something. But right now, as long as we have these dueling factors where we have the public wanting to be safe yet sharing information and not understanding how much risk it can put them at, combined with the regulatory, not that I disagree with the regulatory drive, but it is extremely complex trying to deal with all of the regulatory bodies. I was just reading the NISTIC document. I think that's a great direction, but that's for this country. Now, I don't see us getting to a really viable solution near term that's going to protect people when they do e-commerce in every situation.
Thank you. Last panelist is Jonathan from another big corporation.
Yeah, so much like Stephen has brought up, we have a foot in both worlds. We have a foot in the internet, the cyber world, where for purposes of convenience and cost reduction, it's become very easy to move goods around the world. You may be moving that within the United States. You may be moving that cross-border. It may be occurring in Europe. And the balancing act is what I'll call it, and I kind of liken it to the seal on the ball who's trying to balance something. It changes daily. Whether it's complying with a new state directive that's become more specific to data protection, whether it's a new interpretation of an existing European privacy directive, ultimately. Those decisions, which take a while to play out, also take a while to manifest themselves from a practical standpoint in how all of us consume services. The term of user versus consumer, seemed to be a hot button today. I look at it as I have both. I have people who are direct customers. They are, in fact, people who tendered a package, and I have certain obligations, both contractually and legally, to service them. And then I have users, people who may be interested because, I told you I'm sending you something, or hey, look for this, and I'm giving you information which you're going to use to access the particular status of a package somewhere. So what obligations might I have in you coming to my site and I'm collecting certain information about you to, number one, give you the experience you expect, but number two, potentially, sell you additional services, let you know about particular offerings. So I think the area of privacy is highly subjective, as we've all discussed today. I think the challenges going forward in the context of what do I want, clear direction. And I think that in many of the other sessions that we've had today, there's been a more defined understanding of what it is we're talking about. And as we opened up for this panel, there is no standing definition of privacy. And to Marcus's point, what it's going to mean to a citizen in Europe and what it's going to mean to somebody in New York is going to be completely different. I think this, to take it a step further to the Mark Zuckerberg comment, the default is sharing. Well, okay, generationally speaking, contextually speaking, that may be the truth, but unless I know something about you, I cannot determine any of that information, right? You're just an anonymous person coming to a site to ask for information, to use a service, et cetera. Until there's something known about you, until you're passing some sort of authenticator, then that's not even known as to what I may be able to present you, right? So I think that that's part of our challenge, which is how do I ask you a question that doesn't violate your privacy rights that allows me to then service you in a way that you actually expected? And I think that from a technology perspective, from an implementation perspective, that's what, developers are struggling with when they read business requirements for a new product or service offering to say, okay, but I'm supposed to do all this functionality without actually knowing anything about the customer. It's really a tough nut to crack. So I think the practicality of a new model really has to embrace some amount of information that is coming to you from an authenticator, and as Vince said earlier, at some point during the transaction, when the sensitivity of the information, the use of the information is going to cross some predefined threshold, we're gaining your consent in order to conduct the rest of the transaction.
Thank you. Yes,
could I follow up on that?
Sure.
No, because that's one of the things that's mentioned in the privacy report is that things like first-party marketing, order fulfillment, transaction authentication, you shouldn't have to seek consumers' consent. Consumers need to be educated, or we need to come to a societal consensus that, by doing that, you're consenting to give your information. It's the only way that those kinds of transactions can work in a safe and secure environment. What Do Not Track is trying to get at is gathering information from your online web activity, aggregating that information, selling it to advertisers who have a profile of you based on your online activity from various sites, not just from when you're going to your UPS site to check your status of your package or your Citibank account to find out the balance on your credit card, but rather, you know, all your web browsing, you know, you leave these little breadcrumbs, I think is the word that they're using down there, and they're aggregated, and the analytics get more and more powerful, and those profiles are used by advertisers. And one of our real concerns is that not only are advertisers ultimately going to have access to that information, but at some point, given the robustness of that data and the power of the analytical tools, others, whether they're bad guys or whether they're, you know, insurance companies, employers, anybody who wants to know something about you, at some point there's a real fear that the collection of that data will be available to others. And when you go to apply for health insurance, your insurer will be able to figure out whether you've been looking at fatty recipes on the internet. And that is a real concern. So the do not track is not dealing with first-party interaction on the internet. It's the aggregation of all the various places that you visit on the internet and the profile that is accumulated from all those interactions and used by advertisers to target ads to you. And in many ways, it's not the targeting of the ads to you that is of so much concern. It's perhaps other uses of that profile that has been created of you that might be used for other purposes.
Yeah, just to follow up on that. So I think that the other, you know, confusion that's out there regarding the privacy report and where I think we get on divergent paths is, you know, I read it in somebody's blog the other day, the discussion of privacy versus security, and, you know, personal privacy means nobody knows anything about what you're doing except the other party that you've authorized. National security is full transparency, ability to look at this. And I think the world we live in today is kind of pushing on that, where, you know, from a profile perspective, how do we from a commerce perspective or we from a nationalistic protection perspective know whether you're a bad guy or whether your intentions are in fact not just the commercial transaction? And I think that that's where privacy, you know, is finding some of its first challenges in the practical implementation of fraud detection, fraud prevention, screening, things of that nature. I don't know if you're...
No, I mean, there's clearly a tension between privacy and security. And, you know, one of the hopes of the privacy report was to spur some discussion about this. I think the Commerce Department report has done the same. But as a society, we need to discuss these issues. And they're hard issues. They're not easy issues to resolve because, first off, the technology is moving at light speed. So that changes constantly. So it's not easy to have black and white rules with, you know, subparts, and you can check out the box and you know you've done what you're supposed to do. I mean, what you need to do changes daily as for industry. And the lack of consensus on what's private. 16-year-old girls probably have a different view of what's private than 45-year-old men. Either way, but it's such a personalized issue that trying to come to consensus is difficult. I certainly wouldn't want to suggest this is an easy issue.
I'll just point out one more complicating factor in all of this, which is that as identity technologies advance, one of the things that users are looking for, an experience that they want, is the ability to delegate, to authenticate once, and to delegate to second and third party sites. You cross a very fine line when a user wants to share with Flickr for something, but they want a set of conditions around what's shared on Flickr. And when you cross that boundary from one first party to a second first party with delegated identity, where the user isn't clear that they've now made Flickr a first party, there's a very complicated dance going on behind the scenes to make your experience seamless and usable, but it creates a set of parties acting on your behalf that you may not know you're dancing with.
I think that's a very good point, because something we're struggling with in banking is the fact, I just read the other day that upwards of 40% of online transactions are actually performed by aggregators. So, for example, Mint.com, things like that. And I think from a regulatory perspective, this isn't really clear. You know, if my customer, a banking customer, goes to Mint.com or any of the others, or quite a few, and they create their account, they then input their credentials so that these sites can then, I mean, effectively, all they can't transact. All it's doing is a screen scrape and bring back their statement information. Nevertheless, I think there's confusion there whether now that aggregator is in effect acting as a first party. And I think that this, from my perspective, this is a challenge for some of the regulators that we talk with because they say, oh, well, that's a Citibank site. So, no, it's not. We have no contractual relationship with them. We don't give them any information. Yet I understand that it is very confusing, particularly if one of those sites has a significant breach, you know, because it's us, it's B of A, it's, you know, probably every online bank is their data is being scraped and brought onto those sites. It's a great convenience to the consumer. I have two grown children. They both use them. I won't, but, you know, people are. I mean, 40% of all online banking transactions is a huge number.
I'm also looking to the audience. We hope to have the session as interactive as possible. Are there questions coming from the audience? There are mics in the back of the room.
Yeah, I also submitted this on the back channel, but I'll just read it off. I'm a big fan of Jane Yakowitz's paper, The Tragedy of the Data Commons, in which she argues that the inadequacy of reasonable anonymization requirements are overblown, that we can effectively anonymize data with, yes, some leaks, but it's all balance, a trade-off, and that overall with reasonable anonymization standards, we can open up an incredibly valuable and vitally necessary set of data for understanding, you know, diseases and social problems and so on. So I don't know if you're familiar with the paper, but if not, I highly recommend it. And I think it's a well-balanced approach.
So I think it's a very thorny issue, and there are some really important words in what you said. So I think the threat of de-anonymization is real. I think that, you know, all those cases where data has been de-anonymized, that's because it wasn't anonymized. I mean, something was done to it, and some people called it anonymization. But the things that make that data interesting are things about people, and there are ways, like differential privacy that I mentioned, that can perhaps take some of that out. But I think the policy question, the social question, the question to discuss is, when is it a good idea to say the value that can be unlocked by using this information is so high that we are going to take some risks? But I think it's important to be clear that that's a decision and to be clear that there are risks, especially with things like health information, where there's such benefit that can be gained, but there's also a lot of really personal values and potential harm that can happen. So I think downplaying the idea that that it is a risk is the wrong approach, especially because the more data becomes available in the future, the more possible it is to do that de-anonymization. So even if I look at how today's external data sources, even if I knew about all of them, might allow some data to be linked to a particular person, that doesn't mean that standard can only go down in the future. So I think it's really important to make explicit decisions, to talk about the benefits and the risks, and then you still get back to all the same problems about who gets to decide which is more important, and how you balance those competing concerns. But I do think the risk of de-anonymization is real.
Other questions? Down there, right?
So I'm just reiterating a question from earlier that wasn't really addressed about Bitcoin and what all of your thoughts are on this anonymous currency system that exists, so-called anonymous currency system. And then also just a curious question about a possible antithesis to Bitcoin, like a completely transparent system that would then be governed by users, semi, I guess, on the same principle as Wikipedia, just protecting each other's information through a through basically a distributed network for maybe small transactions. But so what are your thoughts on Bitcoin as the anonymous currency and then a possibly completely transparent currency?
I think that's a question for the banker.
It wouldn't use such a system.
Exactly. We couldn't use it, but I do think it's a fascinating concept, especially for small transactions. Certainly, regulators will flip out at the idea of not being able to track the movement of currency. Obviously, that's, you know, it is another very thorny issue. I don't have a strong professional opinion because, as Van says, we can't touch it. But I think it is a very interesting concept. I don't think we'd be allowed to. I could be wrong. But at this point, we certainly couldn't be allowed to.
I'd like to ask a question. Follow-up question.
My name is Jay Sulzberger. I'm the corresponding secretary of LXNY, which is a little organization pushing free software in New York City. Your answer is absolutely fascinating. I'm not sure. May I ask you, sir, which bank you work for?
Citibank.
I know nothing about Citibank. However, there is something called, and this gets in the newspapers even, the financial pages, where no information correct about the banking industry and Wall Street in general ever gets printed. But they even now admit, since the blow-up and subsequent fraud, that there's something called a shadow banking system. There are huge anonymous transactions which directly affect basically many ordinary working people in the world. So I don't think that the objection of the official banks quite to Bitcoin lies along the axis of we're not for secret transactions. Would you like to show me the ledger of your bank and which transactions it's performed?
I think you're confusing banking with trading.
Quite so, sir.
Okay. I have no involvement with trading for at least 6 years, but the shadow banking that you're talking about is in the trading areas.
You never lend money to these people?
Me personally, no.
I don't think the issue is who's doing it.
No, and certainly from what we've all lived through in the last few years, I think it's a concern to everyone. But I just want to clarify that it's primarily a trading issue. And, you know, certainly hedge funds, things like that, not to point the finger at anyone, but there is enormous amounts of money that moves around without anyone looking at it. We don't have that luxury. Could be. Yes, I'm sure there is a lot of tax avoidance.
There's another.
Kalia, before we move on to the next question, just one more thing about Bitcoin. I actually think one of the most interesting things about Bitcoin is not the anonymous factor. The thing that I think is interesting about Bitcoin is that we've seen several representations now of internet coinage, and they've all been captive. You can put money into Linden, you can't take it out. You can put money into Facebook and give it to Zynga, but you can't take it out. You can put money into the hub and exchange for services, but you can't take money back out. The interesting thing about Bitcoin to me is that it actually is monetized in two directions.
Okay. Question from the floor.
My name's Kalia Hamlin. My handle's Identity Woman, for those of you wondering. I was just going to ask Lucy to comment on how NSTIC relates to privacy, and if it does, because I liked your definition the best. And, you know, we just had somebody from NTIA talk about, you know, what they're doing, and then there's the privacy green paper from Commerce and the Do Not Track, and then there's NSTIC. And I'm really concerned that NSTIC is putting forward very strong ideals about what these systems could be, and the market is not incentive to move that direction because everybody wants identifiers that are linkable to track everybody so we can sell them more stuff without their awareness.
I'm happy to respond, but Vint also wants to jump in, and I would let him. Well, does everybody here know that the NSTIC is the National Strategy for Secure Identities Online? Okay, so with that level set, Urban, you want to go first? And then.
Okay, so I want to be able to face people in this response. Earlier on, when I talked about distinguishing identifiers from identity, I was thinking NSTIC. And my interpretation of the NSTIC proposition is that it creates a competitive environment for high-quality authentication of identifiers. Not identity, but identifiers. It's unfortunate that the term identity showed up in the NSTIC name, but I've talked at length with Howard Schmidt and others who worked on that, and it is my understanding and belief that they were trying to foster a competitive industry in the strong authentication of identifiers. I would not for a moment argue that therefore we have no identity issue, because we plainly can bind identifiers to identity. But I think that that's something that we as users would like to have at least some control over. Now, the problem is that once you have established a strong identifier, others may accumulate information about your transactions that are associated with that identifier about which you may not know anything. And that, of course, argues for transparency. But I urge you not to condemn NSTIC in the belief that it's a national identity system or anything like that, because I don't believe that's the intent, and I don't believe that's the substance.
So I would agree that in its pure form, that's the high-level goal of the NSTIC. I think the devil is in some of the details, and there are a lot of things that have converged in the NSTIC that I think are problematic. It's being billed as a private-public partnership to drive commodity-driven identifying solutions for end users. I think it assumed a degree of maturity in the identity provision side that doesn't exist yet. There are very interesting technologies. The combination of the next generation of OpenID and OAuth is interesting. There are existing SAML technologies that are interesting. Microsoft actually had a user-centric technology called Information Card, which is now feature complete, read dead, at least for the short term. But none of those technologies have really converged into an architecture and a system yet where you would be able to use the individual pieces as when you as a user need them in the context that I talked about earlier. So one of the things that Vint mentioned here is what I think of as content drift for the user. I use what I think is a low-value identifier because I want to post persistently to a blog. But that happens to be a nice handle, so then I begin to use it in slightly more high-value transactions. I use it to comment on a government site that's in the civic public space. The government tracks that. I then use it for something more. I register with National Institute of Health and contribute to a database, and that's a very highly proofed identity. And I, as a user, don't always have the context to know when I've slid up the context ladder in terms of tracking and proofing. And I don't think this is a problem singular to the NSTIC. I think anybody who is looking at providing the end user with the way to manage their identities across contexts in a simple way runs up against these problems. The NSTIC, I think, is more likely to fail around trying to drive immature business cases on a short time frame than they are around their insidious plans for collecting all your data. I actually think they have design problems that are at a deeper level.
Another question from the floor. Shall we take the... We're beginning to run out of time. We take the question.
Sorry, Eric Pfluger, New York ISOC chapter member. I'm interested in opportunity. I have questions about opportunities for class bias to creep into processes for verifying or authenticating an identity. In other words, you know, the old joke about, or caption about, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog, you know, but it implies, you know, a certain kind of neutrality, and in cases where people are, say, debating ideas, meritocracy. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, or whether you've got a PhD or you're a high school dropout, you know, you sink and swim on what you on the merits of what you have to say. And I'm just wondering if, depending on what kind of information you need to establish an identity that's satisfactory to your purposes, you, well, what are the criterion for a satisfactory third-party verifier? You know, do you need the person you're trying to verify, whose identity you're trying to verify, do you need him to have a bank account? Do you need him to have a diploma? Do you need him to have a driver's license? In other words, you know, and what happens, what are the consequences of somebody who didn't have an opportunity to go to school and has a sustenance-level job and does all his dealings in cash and doesn't have a bank account, but somehow has a smartphone and is getting online? You know, is he on a level playing field with somebody who has all that stuff? Thanks. That's the question.
Can we take a series of questions and then ask the panel collectively?
Just on link going with Verizon, just I've been involved in privacy policy for quite a number of years, and sometimes it seems like we get really complex in how we look at these issues, and sometimes we don't step back a little bit. And I had a presentation made to me by the Taufer Associates a few years ago, a really interesting presentation on privacy. One of the points that they ended up with was that a key driver what ought to shape policy in this space is that you, whatever you do in gathering data for the consumer, you shouldn't surprise them. And I think that's a really good metric, because if you understand that going in, gathering the data, then that also colors how you ask them for permission and what you're going to do with the data. So it actually does both pretty well. And I just wonder what your reaction is to that, because I do think sometimes we overcomplexify some of these things with all the different principles we've got and so forth.
There's a gentleman over there.
What are the panelists' thoughts, sorry, on a possible privacy model where the amount of information that is pulled from a user would actually depend on the amount that they voluntarily share on the internet, similar to like a cloud score now, where they can start to measure how much influence you have, and just some thoughts on that.
I think we have 12 panelists. Would you
sure
comment on the various questions? Comments?
Sure, thanks. The class bias issue is a fascinating one. We spend a lot of our time in consumer protection dealing with scams that target people who are desperate. They're on the brink of foreclosure and falling victim to mortgage foreclosure rescue scams. They're hopelessly in debt and falling victim to debt reduction, credit repair schemes. Last week, I was at a forum with the Immigration Service and various law enforcers dealing with immigration scams, where people who have immigration problems end up getting scammed by people they think are lawyers or the government because they don't have the tool. They're desperate. So as more and more of the world is done through e-commerce and the internet, lack of education on some of these things becomes an even bigger problem. So, you know, a big push in the privacy report is that we do need greater consumer education. There is a wonderful publication that the agency has put out that is available for free. It's called NetCetera. It's aimed at tweens, essentially, and it's a great tool for parents, teachers, community organizations to use with their kids. I mean, we teach hygiene in school, and given the amount of life that now happens on the internet, we need to start teaching our children internet hygiene so they know how to protect themselves out there. The no surprise comment is exactly, I think, sort of where the Federal Trade Commission is. We want there to be transparency, consumers to understand what data is being collected and what use is going to be made of it, and for the consumer to have some control. And then the last question, I didn't really have a...
One of the things that's fascinating to me about the class question, it gets back to one of Vince's comments earlier about the continuing need for anonymity on the network. I think if I look at myself and I look at the transactions that I do online every day, 75% of what I do is identifiable only by the system information that I give. It knows my browser. It knows my IP address. It has that identifying information. But I surrender no personal data at all. And another 15% or so is stuff that I do where I want a persistent persona. So I comment on things or I log into a site for a personalized experience or whatever. Very little of it requires a really high degree of proofing. And I think in terms of the open internet, when we talk about these privacy issues, we're really talking about things at the corner cases, the need for anonymity because there is a political consequence, the need for high proofing for something that has a high transaction value, and that we need to remember that a lot of our experience is in the middle, and that that middle experience doesn't need to be as subject to the kinds of discrimination that you're talking about. The no surprise comment, I think that's exactly right. The one thing that I would say is that past that surprise, there is a place for the consumer to be able to change their mind. So the ability to revoke or to change terms over time, I think, is a more and more interesting question, particularly as people delegate and then age out of uses and want to change the terms of how they interact.
Thank you. Rebecca?
Yeah, so let's see. I think the class issue is a really important one, and I see that as coming under this umbrella of remembering that privacy means different things to different people in different contexts, and you know, understanding their perception may be colored by their own experiences and abilities and exposure. So I think that's really important to remember. As far as the no surprises, I think that's very useful, and the mismatch of expectations as defining what is a privacy violation is also that way. I think there is one danger there to remember, which is that one way to not surprise people or violate their expectations is to lower expectations and just have it be very clear all the time that you should expect nothing and no privacy. So, you know, I think you just need to make sure that that's not where the solutions get driven to any more than they're already being driven there by other factors.
Yeah, I guess on the point of the class issue, you know, I agree with what Lucy is saying. You know, I think that ultimately servicing somebody's transaction based on, you know, them being able to provide out-of-wallet type questions, right? Those artifacts that we accumulate through our lives that provide some credibility to an identity, I think in some way have to be separated to what they really are, which is identifiers, right? And ultimately, until you reach a point, transactionally speaking, where you've crossed some kind of financial threshold, safety threshold, you know, that you're retrieving previously disclosed personal identifiable or personal health or financial information, I think that's where the line has to be drawn. I think that does turn this a little bit into the haves and have-nots, you know, at that point. On the no surprise comment, I agree with Rebecca. I think lowering the expectation right up front is the way to go, because what may not have surprised you today, as we accumulate more and more information, as the technology gets better, it becomes in real time, facial recognition comes into play, all of a sudden you will be surprised what can be done with that same information a year from now, 2 years from now. And I think that that's certainly a challenge that we all have to take into consideration as we interact with sites ourselves and our user base. And I guess just to that last question, if I kind of understood that correctly, what you're really saying is there a potential of using a reputational trusted score in order to protect or at least identify me as an individual moving through the internet? I think that's I think it's been tried. I think there's different models that have met with different levels of success. I think ultimately we get back into the federation game. Who is in fact the authoritative source of saying they trust you, and do you in fact trust them?
On the class issue, I think this is probably one of the biggest challenges that my industry has, certainly, because there's a huge part of the world, that is what we refer to as unbanked. People that, I mean, good examples are East Africa, where they have, you know, in a very short time, have this enormous distribution of cell phones. It's staggering and impressive and transformative. And I think that something that our industries together are going to have to come up with a way to deal with the fact that these people cannot provide the sort of credentials that we in the West take for granted. Things you're talking about, government-provided credentials. We have to come up with a solution. I'm not certainly don't know what it is, but there's a huge need. And as we know, if there's a huge need and it has a commercial impact, people are going to find a solution for it. I think with the no surprises, I thought it was interesting the comment about this NetCetera. I sit on a task force that's looking at account takeover, which is a big issue in all financial services. And a big part of that is an effort to educate people. And it's not just young people. You know, when people find out what I do, the questions that I get asked just flabbergast me that the average person is uninformed about the threat landscape that's out there. They're uninformed. They don't think of it. They don't have any. It's just frankly staggering. I think that a lot of education needs to happen for people in general. You know, we talked before about the convenience problem, and that's part of the convenience problem. We push our business to put more information up on these websites to make people more aware, and they're reluctant to do it because a lot of people don't have a positive reaction when you tell them that if you do such and such, it's risky behavior and may wind up with your identity being stolen. It is, a couple of years in a row, the largest reported consumer problem, and it's not diminishing, and certainly probably those of us in the room are very aware of these issues, but I don't think that the average consumer or user is. And I think the consumer-user distinction is great because we have the same sort of thing where, you know, you have a customer who's trying to make a payment to someone else and the person on the other end didn't get their payment, that kind of thing. So it's an interesting segregation between how you handle they both have very valid needs for information, and yet you may not have any way of authenticating the user as opposed to your consumer.
Thank you. Well, this is, I think, my main lesson from this panel, that much needs to be done to educate the user, the consumer. And the way to move forward, I think, is business alone cannot do it, regulator alone cannot do it, and I think we all have to work together in a multi-stakeholder approach, as Larry Strickling said in his way forward, I think. May I ask you to join me in thanking the panelists for the excellent presentation?